Okay, good. So this is Regina Kong interviewing for the Hobbit Hole Oral History Project. I'm with Paul Johnson today. It's July 8th, 2019. I guess, could we start, just restate your name and tell me a little bit about where you were born.
Okay. She's going to give me my starboard hearing aid here.
Perfect.
Thank you. I was born in Juneau, St. Anne's Hospital.
Can you state your name for me too?
Yeah, my name's Paul Johnson. I was born in Juneau, May 28, 1952, and raised there. My father worked at Juneau Coal Storage, so I grew up in the fish business, and we lived 24 miles out of town by the Shrine. So my father, Juneau Coal Storage, was from bottling Coca-Cola to a freezing plant for fish to a cannery.
And then how did your parents end up in Alaska?
Well, my dad's family came up. They came from Finland and worked their way up towards Alaska. And my mother chased my dad up here. She met Dad at the University of Washington and chased my dad up here. So they got married in Juneau, August 1st, 1940. So they lived in Pelican for quite a while and lived in Douglas for a while and out the road. And they both passed away in Juneau.
And so what was your dad doing?
My dad managed this plant that froze fish and canned, and it also bottled Coca-Cola, believe it or not. Mm. Yep.
And so were you the only kid, or were there others?
No, I have a sister who still lives right next door to me. She's 15 months older than me, and then I have a brother who's 6 years older than me, and he spent his life in the fish business and just retired. He lives in my grandfather's house. I live in my parents' house. My sister lives right next door to me.
Hmm. So, did you stay in Alaska pretty much your entire life?
Not yet.
Okay.
Yes. I graduated from high school in 1970, went up to Fairbanks, attempted college, left there, came back down, and had an exciting time in Fairbanks. In fact, Greg Howe was there at the time. Fred Howe was there at the time. Came back down and picked up an old mail boat that used to run out here, the Forester. And Dave Reichel had bought another boat to run mail with and freight. And we came out to the islands here to buy seine fish. And seine fishing died off that year, and so then we started buying crawfish. So, been here ever since. Mm-hmm. So that was 1973.
Why did you just decide to stay here?
You know, it was just a fluke. At that time, there was a huge controversy going on about our fish runs. They were whittled way down. A lot of folks felt the Indian Islands here was a bottleneck for fish to go through, and but seining was the lifeblood of this area, and Indian Islands was the bread and butter for everybody for seining. In fact, right out the Hobbit Hole was what they called the station. So the cannery, Excursion Inlet, was the big one here, and all the Peter Pan and Hawk Inlet was another one, and so all those fishermen, and some from down south, the Frenoloviches were one of the big ones. They called it the Laundry, which is just right outside the Hobbit Hole there. If you go down the Laundry, you'll notice there's a painted rock, and that was one of the hookoffs for seining there. And it was closed in the fall of 73. So having some place to turn, there was a fellow buying fish out here on the Fern Second. Art Berthold, and he had a heart attack and a partial stroke. And the guys were, trollers were looking for somebody to buy fish, so I was anchored up waiting for some seiners because we were buying what they call money fish out of, from the seiners. And I ended up getting into the troll business, and then next year in 74 built a scow, the one that's still there. And with Greg Howe, we pulled it up from Seattle and started buying fish in Elfin Cove and out at Deer Harbor with the boat. And so I stuck it out in Elfin Cove until 95.
What was Elfin Cove like then?
Oh, a whole different world. We were going through the change of time, but it was mainly a commercial fishing community. Limited entry was being discussed and talked about and happened in 75, but in 74 it was still open. Vietnam War was ending. There was a lot of people looking for something else to do, so a lot of young people were coming out and started fishing. And then all of a sudden in 75, they had to make a decision, but there was one little hole left open that you could go hand trolling. And so a lot of people started out that were in that group hand trolling, but power trolling was closed down. Hand trolling was left open without limited entry. So Elfin Cove had a mixture of a new influence of young people and a lot of the old timers who lived there and had for several years, most of them, and fished just locally. They weren't, most of them were not fishermen who went much beyond, well, they used to call Port Althorp the Inside Banks instead of the Fairweather Grounds. That was their nickname. Mm-hmm. But most of them would, maybe the first they go is Murphy Cove or Deer Harbor, but it was a whole different world. Whole different world. Nobody even, I don't think, could conceive what's happened to Elfin Cove today.
Can you explain a little bit more about what's changed from then and now?
Well, as limited entry came along, obviously.
What is limited entry?
Limited entry is they took the number of fishermen who had fished a certain key number of years and they got a permit. Mm-hmm. That permit then became, out of a fluke, became sellable and transferable. And anybody else that wanted to get in either had to buy one of those permits because there was a limited number of them. It was a project that was meant to help economically and use conservation on resource to put a cap on effort. But part of that, when the islands closed down to seining, the village people several of them were hand trolling, but other people, because on every seine boat, there was six guys, five to six at that time, that worked on seine boats. And they were left without anything. So hand trolling was left open, and there was other people, and around our area, a lot of young guys. So it basically had one end open, and the power trollers were capped at four lines below Cape Suckling, six lines above Cape Suckling. And so the cove worked around totally on fish, sales of food, fuel, booze, had a laundromat. A lot of wintertime folks that stuck through the year in the winter. And so as time went along, first there was a major, after the islands were closed, all of Icy Strait clear out to Cross Sound was put on 8 days on fishing, 6 days off to work with the cohos. They finally came up and put a cap on the number of hand trollers and only two lines instead of four. A lot of agony going on at that time period. And quite a few of the guys then started buying power troll permits. moving up, and when they were stuck with two lines and their shoulders gave up because they were trying to run hand gurdies and stuff, they moved up. And so the fleet eventually became a power troll fleet, almost overall, not completely, but almost overall. And but most of them were just local fellas. And through that process, the Hobbit Hole, of course, became a fleet of its own, or a group of their own, who became very talented at fishing locally. We were able to get the Board of Fish to allow to get off the 8 days on, 6 days off, and work towards catching humpies at the islands with a 500 cap on kings, and basically pink salmon are what saved the day for that group of fishermen. They caught the money fish too, chums and a few sockeyes and some silvers, but humpies was, pinks were the was the big, big deal. In fact, they got so efficient that after the seiners got closed down and were pushed further inside Icy Straits, a lot of seiners were concerned about the amount of humpies these guys could catch and clean. Eventually, we went to buying them in the round, but you know, we were paying 40, 45 cents period of time, up to 50 cents, even higher. The guys did well and worked hard. And the Hobbit Hole fleet was a little group of themselves who produced a lot, worked hard, got better and better boats, got more efficient. Then got into the season started shortening up, where on the King Salmon Treaty that came along right in the early 80s and hit hard and closed the season till July 1st. We used to, there was no season prior to that. I mean, you went out fishing, and so we started buying the first part of May and didn't end until the end of September, or 20th September, basically. So things started rapidly changing. You had a limited number of fleet. You had the season squished down. But we were able, again, to get the islands opened up before the main season in June. And Douglas Island Pink and Chum Hatchery was producing a lot of pinks at that time. And the northern end here just blossomed with lots of pink salmon. And these trollers went out, there was one guy, or a couple guys, in fact, three or four guys, who always did fish pinks. I mean, that's they didn't leave off a cove. One guy they called the Humpy King, Roy Clements. But so these guys kind of followed, the Hobbit Hole fleet kind of followed what Roy did and some of the other guys did, but got very, very good at it, improved their gear, improved their boats, improved on the quality of the fish. And so we bought lots and lots of humpies. Lots and lots of humpies.
So what made the Hobbit Hole fishermen more talented than other people?
I don't know if they were more... basically, I think they were all younger, willing to work hard. They changed their gear to shorten up between the spreads and different things like that. They learned how to clean fish quickly, and then of course once we got into round fish, that saved a lot of guys' hands. But energetic bunch who communicated with each other, and they went for it. And then of course, when that season started shortening up in the late 60s, a guy came up with halibut fishing instead of a skate that had what they called stuck gear with the hooks put in the line, snap-on gear where they could snap-on came along. Larry Chantry is the guy that started that. And so halibut seasons were not during the main part of salmon season, so these same folks got in and got gear and started halibut fishing. And again, there was a lot of people got into it, same kind of scenario, and they ended up having it set on a quota, and the quota was caught in 5 days, then 4 days, and then 3 days. So eventually they went to what's called individual fishing quotas. Most of those folks were qualified for individual fishing quotas and ended up receiving those. And again, those are a sellable, viable commodity. And as time's gone along, a lot of that is leaving our state, and the smaller communities don't have the money to buy them. So that whole aspect has been disappearing as well. And limited entry permits, there's some of the families who are still on it and working hard, but our humpies on the northern end here have not come up to the level that they were at that time period. And there's a lot of people trying to sort out, but you know, obviously the hatcheries, you know, a lot of those fish were hatchery fish, and how many strays and how that's affected the northern end, you know, time will tell, but we really don't know. But the Hobbit Hole fleet was a group of hardworking guys and gals, not just guys, gals. And some people would come and go out of that group, attempt to do the same things and not make it. But that same core group stuck along for quite a while. And then, of course, as the humpies started going, this next generation's going out further than that group did. You know, those folks that are now going out to the ocean and fishing. But there's not many even those left. And they're interesting. The next generation is quite a bit into, well, there's some of those people were too, but the old generation, if you went from here to Seattle, that was a big deal. If you went from here to Juneau in your boat, it was a big deal. Whereas the group today and started changing with after the Vietnam War there and that era, there's a lot of really phenomenal wanderlust with a lot of those folks. They've traveled a lot. But so it's become more and more summertime, not year-round situation. Greg stuck it out year-round and did his winter fishing and obviously was one of the top guys on the Pinks, and during other times did well up the coast on king salmon for a short trip, but eventually would come back and fish Pinks.
So you said you met Greg in Fairbanks.
No, Greg rode our bus. Greg's dad came here, and I don't nail me exactly on the dates, but he graduated in 69, so they either came in the fall of 64. There was a guy by the name of Mitchell who was a superintendent of the park, and his daughter graduated in 64, so they must have come in 65. And Greg and his brother came to Juneau, and Greg rode our bus. Fred went to Fairbanks to go to school. And wherever Bob Howe, their father, had been, he had bought a piece of property wherever he had been stationed. And Doug and Flo Freed had put the place, Indian Islands, up for sale. There was another guy that lived there, John Adelson. But Doug and Flo put the place up for sale, and a guy by the name of Brownie, he worked for the light company in Juneau, bought it, tried trolling, and I think had it maybe 3 years or so. And then he put it up for sale. And with Bob's encouragement, I'm sure, Greg and Fred bought it in 73. I think it was 73. Had to be. Spring of 73. Something like this. No, I knew Greg when he first moved here. He rode the bus, and then we spent a lot of time. Another fellow, Rick Norvell, and Greg, and some of Rick's cousins and stuff. Yeah, we did a lot of trips. So Greg worked, bought fish on the Forester in 73, and in 74 worked on the scow. In fact, he helped bring the scow up from Seattle. And then 75, everything collapsed. They closed the fisheries August 1st. But I think Greg had already gone up to Fairbanks to work on the on a company for welding shop up there settling an auction and those kind of things. And then eventually came back down and started fishing.
What do you mean by everything collapsed?
They closed the season August 1st. The fish didn't show. And it was a tough deal. The cohos didn't, just didn't show up, just didn't appear, and everybody was shut down. And basically, it was the end of that season. A lot of hurt folks. That was first year of limited entry. And some people had bought permits and put money into their boats, and boom. Yeah, pretty devastating year. But that happens in the fish business. And will happen again.
Did you know that you were going to be a fisherman when you were...
I wasn't fishing. I bought fish.
Oh, you bought fish.
I bought fish from these guys. No.
Did you ever consider fishing yourself?
Not really. My dad was a fish buyer. My brother spent his life doing it. We started in Elfin Cove, or first on the Forester, and then in Elfin Cove, and it kept growing. We bought some property from Agnes Slosher there, and they'd had a restaurant on it, so we got a restaurant, kept it going, and built a store on land, and built a laundromat on land with showers and crew quarters. And at one point in time, between buying blackcod and halibut and summer salmon, we were over 4 million pounds of product we were buying there a year. So, yeah, it was a little going concern for a while.
So how much time did you spend at the Hobbit Hole?
Well, when Greg first bought it, in fact, one night, I'll never forget, we were out at George Island buying fish, and things had died off, and we hopped on a skiff. Greg came on the boat halfway through the year on that. It was a guy that was working on the boat that had to go to school, Jerry Mason. And Greg had seen it only once before, I think. Anyway, we went in, and that was in the summer of 73. And then over time, going over to visit Greg, and I left one winter a scow on the beach there and stuff. But I wasn't, I'd go over and visit the folks there, but I wasn't part of that group because I was buying fish in Elfin Cove. And then I got involved in chartering, too, at the same time as things were tightening up to try to keep that operation going. Because the season's tightened up, and, of course, obviously, the world changed with the Costcos in the world and that kind of thing, where we couldn't really compete with hauling groceries into Elfin Cove and booze and stuff at the same level we used to. Everything was slowly going down. So I started chartering and then sold to Excursion Inlet Packing in 1995 and moved over here.
What does chartering mean?
Well, I take bear hunts out in the spring and the fall, and had been doing that for years. And take trips up the coast, up Glacier Bay, and we take some fishing trips, whatever anybody wants to do. So basically, we lease ourselves out to people to see the country.
I was wondering, do you remember the first time you saw the Hobbit Hole?
I know it was that summer of 73.
Right.
It was at Brownie left it absolutely spotless, and I remember going in there, and it was old school, but well taken care of, and I remember it being in good shape and painted and so forth, and of course Greg put a lot of work into it. In fact, like on the hydro line, I traded Greg. He ran up a boat for me, and I hauled his pipe up for him for the hydro on one of the tenders. But Greg put his heart and soul in, and so did Fred, putting in the hydro and making a living there. So it's just interesting the way things have turned out. Zach seems to have great enthusiasm to make a place where people can come.
How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, you got, and originally when I heard it, you got kind of, again, mixed feelings. I mean, Greg and Fred were ready to get out, and there was a price tag that had changed radically of values of property. I mean, Alaska's seeing wealth come from other places and so forth. But I think they were somewhat prudent that, you know, it wouldn't just end up being one of those. But at the same time, losing what it was before of knowing that it wasn't going to be a family who lived there, who worked there for fishing or anything else, that it was going to become a larger type operation. Yeah, it's a change. I think it's better than it could have gone by a long shot of becoming a lodge or something along that lines. There's a lot of give and take, and obviously Greg and Fred needed money to live on and did the best they could. But yeah, it's just like when I built here. It's, you know, for everybody around here seeing this place come into effect when it used to be just a beach and it was, people didn't even know, I think a lot of them, that it was private property. It was a big change for them. It's a big change for the other folks too, so everybody has to adjust. And it's going to adjust a lot more coming up. There's big changes coming. Now there's just so much pressure on the resource. It's not going to sustain. And the politics of things will drive what happens here. But the fishery can't possibly sustain what's happening now, which is already obvious with the humpies and things. It's already there. Because I walk most of the streams from Point Adolphus down towards Cass Bay every fall, and seeing what's happening is pretty shaking. Pretty shaking. Because we lived through that before when we got statehood in the 60s, when we didn't have anything. And then we built it up in the late 60s and the 70s, and it was a struggle. Believe you me, it was a struggle to do that. And then all these people come, and they say, oh, the buffalo run for her, look at all the fish. But it's going to bite them in the butt here.
How much did statehood change things around here?
Well, I was real little, of course. I was 7 years old, when six when it was signed, but seven on the year. And really didn't understand, other than for my parents and all their friends, that we were going to be able to manage the fish, do a better job than what the federal government had done, have our own future directed that way. So fish traps had been here prior to that, and they were allowed to go in some areas to 1960 and some areas to 61, but it was just majorly an anti-fish trap move. And what the project was to spread the economic footprint out by trolling. You know, it's like chopping a tree down with a pocket knife, but having good quality fish that would maintain livelihoods for people. And then we had our gill netting and seining instead of fish traps. And obviously, from that day, radar came, GPSs have come, great depth finders have come, bigger engines, stronger, bigger boats. I mean, for years and years, you know, very few trollers had a deckhand on. Now everybody's got a deckhand. I mean, it's just the pressure is on to produce, to pay bills, and to do, you know, obviously the houses in Elfin Cove have gotten out of reach for young people, you know. They can't. But that's true in Juneau, too. So statehood came along, and that was before oil came. So fishing was a big deal. Timber was another part of Southeast, but not as sustainable as fishing was. So fishing in our family was what the world was about. And when oil came, the concerns about fishery just kept declining. And I mean, Southeast Alaska became an oil-dependent area. Everybody relied on that oil money. So we became the blue-eyed Arabs. Mm-hmm. You know, and it still is controlling the atmosphere today. So I don't know what's coming. It'd be interesting to see. I'd like to live long enough to see what happens. But politics, fish politics, is a tough deal. And 90% of the people don't get involved in it. So it's allocation, obviously, right? So you have the department coming in and say, we have this much resource to get and harvest. And the department produces that to a board, and this board decides, you're going to get it, I'm going to get it, or so-and-so is going to get it. So that's politics and resource. That's allocation. It's not management. But through time, management also has taken more and more control, because that board can't determine opening time periods and closure time periods as things have gotten more complicated, more efficient. So that's affected this whole area, is that the managers do get involved in politics, unfortunately. But there's no way out of the box with a management plan for them, too. So the part of the Hobbit Hole fleet did get, and I can't remember exactly who it was. I don't know if Greg was in it, but we did do run studies on humpies with a guy from the University of Alaska Southeast, Ole Matteson, trying to figure out timings when fish were coming through. That was an interesting project.
Who started that project?
What's that?
Who started the project?
Ole Matteson. Mm-hmm. He had some students out working too, but he came up with trying to figure out if the females show up first or the males show up first, and trying to determine abundance. But everybody has spent a lot of time trying to figure out fish returns, right? In fact, Fred worked on that for Fish and Game when he first came up here. Pre-emergent work where they'd go out in February and go into a stream and try to determine how many little ones are there and try to predict what was going to happen down the road, to trying to do trawling on small nets to figure out out-migrants, to Ole Matteson's type work. And they've really, other than sockeyes, they've really had a difficult time coming up with. Because, a lot of the industry relies on that for how many, in those days, of course, how many cans you needed and how much freezing capacity you needed, how many tenders you needed, and so forth and so on. So.
You mentioned a bit about the Hobbit Hole, what it was like before. Could you sort of describe that, like the atmosphere, the people, what did it feel like to be there?
Well, you know, it was just with Brownie and his wife there, and then before that, that was just Doug and Flo Freed and John Adelson. They turned it into where everybody helped cook and everybody helped keep mechanically things going, working with one another of this little group and this little fleet, and during times off, early spring, getting things set up, they'd work together, and it was an advantage, I think, to everybody, it appeared to me, where they worked together to help everybody receive some of the bounty of the resource. So that was a big difference. It was just a quiet little place before, and it was back to that for Greg in the winter most of the time, but the summer was a busy place, people coming and going, and depending on what was happening. But Greg was very set on his schedule, getting up and fishing so many hours and delivering his fish and then running home and getting a good night's sleep and going forward. But all those guys, they worked at it and helped each other. So that was what, you know, originally, of course, it was a fox farm, right? And, of course, the fox farm, same kind of thing happened where there was one on Shaw Island as well, or one on Three Hill, another one on the other side of Indian Islands. But they had to feed those foxes every day. So the old-timers told me that basically the first few years, it was easy to get food and fish to, or sea lions or whatever they could get their hands on to feed the foxes. And then you had to go a little further, because he cleaned it out there. Then eventually a little further, till it wasn't economical. And of course, fur prices go up and down, just like fish prices did. But the big time was in, it would have been 1932 is when Roosevelt got elected, and Eleanor wore a fox, and it became a fad, and the fox farms did really well for a few years. But still, so it went basically, and then Doug and Flo, you know, Doug was a fisherman, and Flo worked in the store in Elf and Co., but Doug, he was a commercial fisherman. He had a real serious stutter. He'd look at Dad, because Dad was one of those that would try to help, you know, when Doug would stutter, he'd finally blurt out, "Damn it, Johnson, just give me a moment."
Yeah. Do you have any favorite stories or memories about the Hobbit Hole or your time there?
No, they was always just enjoyable. I mean, I have a lot of favorite stories with Greg, because we go back to starting out as kids growing up together, doing different things together, and Greg always had a great sense of humor, and I remember Rick would call him Greg Gano, that was his name. He had a phenomenal mom and quite the dad, but his mother was really special. And so that just continued on at different times. I mean, with going over to visit the Hobbit Hole or him coming to Elfin Cove. But his life got busier with different things. You know, eventually started going less and less. But during those years, Greg was gone. He had a couple guys that were there that were great fun. In fact, I think, I'm not sure who came up with the name Hobbit Hole, but I think maybe Reba did, but I don't know for sure. From Indian Island to the Hobbit Hole. But it was during that time period of the late 70s, somewhere along in that, that people started calling it that. And I think it was Reba, I don't know. But I don't count on that. I honestly don't know. I just always assumed, I guess. He just passed away a couple of years ago. Anyway, I don't know. They were all good. They were all good memories. Greg was, you know, kept in touch over the years. He came the chairman of the community group there in Elfin Cove, because he was kind of detached from the rest, so didn't have a direct involvement in the big pie and stuff. And of course Jane, after he got married to Jane, which has been a long time ago now, she's given her insides to help out Elf and Cove, so they're intertwined, and I suppose that'll be less and less over time here, with Indian Islands doing its own thing. It'll become a direct involvement with the community of Elf and Cove. I haven't heard all what Zach's got planned. I know that hopefully he's going to have some cultural camps and stuff for some Huna kids and things. That's what I kind of encouraged him to do. But he's sure enthusiastic.
I was wondering how because you've known Greg for so long, do you think your relationship has changed as...
Yeah, it's just like any relationship. It's had its ups and downs on over different things, you know. Can't help but be when there's changes in regulations or changes in times, fish prices, those kind of things. It can't help have your ups and downs. And just, you know, marriages come and go and so forth. Yeah, you know, times change. But, you know, I have a lot of fond memories of Greg for many, 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 many years, and had a great chance to talk to him here not too long ago. And he's seems to be very satisfied with being in Gustavus and doesn't have a real strong traveling bug. He's just happy to be there.
Do you have an example of a memory that is really special to you?
With Greg?
Or just in general, with the Hobbit Hole with Greg?
Oh, gosh.
Just living in this area?
Oh, gosh. There was lots of pretty cherished memories. And there was ones that weren't so cherished. You know, I mean, we put the boat on the beach at full bore on Indian Islands. Everybody was working too hard, and that was a pretty exciting day. Greg was with me on that deal. To wonderful times of Easter parties over there, to marriages, to a little bit of everything. I don't know if I have any of those that spikes above the others, you know. But obviously in the summertime, most of my time there was in the spring or in the fall, because in the summertime, everybody was going real strong. I did have different times there when I stopped by with folks when I was chartering, because there was folks that stayed back and cooked and did different things from the fishing. But yeah, the Hobbit Hole was a driving force for Elfin Cove. But as far as, I don't know, more exciting things than the other, it was all good.
Do you visit the Hobbit Hole much now?
I haven't been to the Hobbit Hole for a long time. Our world has gotten busy too. I got married to Tammy, and we had these two kids, and I had an adoptive child, Tim, from before. And so Mom got, and Dad both passed away, and that was a process that cost a lot of money and stuff. And so we ended up putting a lot of time trying to make ends meet. And then my wife and I, in fact, the end of July here, we go up to the Brooks Range nowadays and spend a month and a half or 2 months in the interior of Alaska. And so time is just different. They're doing different things.
Do you think there is any, like, would you want to go back?
Oh, I'd like to go over at some point and see Zach. I certainly don't want to interrupt anything over there. And Zach has got a good focus of where he wants to go, and I'm very hopeful for him. So I'm not up to speed on when he's got a moment or not a moment or whatever, but he's got the work parties. Well, that's in the spring and May. Well, I'm already busy in May. We start the first part of May, so we go real heavy, and this is the first break we've had right now since the first of May. We come out in April, of course, and set things up. I don't know. Time just slides by. And even though you make an intent, like I'm supposed to take Patty Lewis over to Pelican to see Gail Corbin here the next, it just hit me the other day. I told her I would do that, and all of a sudden I'm going, gosh, do I really have time to do that? I don't know. Time just goes. I don't know where it goes. You'll find out. Life is logarithmic. It is the older you get, all of a sudden, that.
Yeah, do you feel like you've gotten busier over the years?
Busier?
Busier, yeah.
No, I don't think I am busier. I mean, you get stuff done in the time you have allotted, but you seem to have a lot longer time to get different things done. Mm. But when you're younger, you know, you say, I can get this done in 2 months, and you'll get it done in 2 months. As you get older, you say, well, it's going to take me 3 months. But you'll always get stuff done the time you allot to get it done. It's just how much you sit around and play cribbage or do something else than get it done.
Do you think your attitudes about like work or life, family, have changed from when you were, you know, in your 20s, 30s?
No, I don't think so. I've never... I can't compare myself to anybody else. You know, I don't have the same work ethic like Greg and those guys had. I mean, they worked hard. I played a lot more. So I haven't changed on that, and I still play a lot and make enough to get by. And obviously, I'm probably out of the whole area. They're one of the last guys still trying to make a living, because I live totally off of this. And those guys are all, a lot of them have backed off or retired. I'm still going because I played. Mm. I did. And I have no regrets. And I'll be going at this a long time. But, and I had a family late, too, in life. So, but I have no regrets.
So you have Alice, and you've one more child?
Yeah. I keep looking for him. Rick, he's got my boat. He took some friends from next door and another friend of his and went out to go fishing and then stopped by Elfin Cove and get fuel. So it's getting 3 o'clock in the morning where he is. Anyway, that's our boat that we take people out on that he's got right now.
Do you think your kids are going to stay here?
You know, I hope so. I mean, I'm trying to keep this piece of property for them. I mean, it's irreplaceable, and I did not want to stay in Elfin Cove. And a lot of it was just like this last week, you know, the fog line when I was running the boats with fish. Elfin Cove would be all fogged in, and I'd come over to this side, and it would be gorgeous sunshine. And after all those years being in Elfin Cove in that fog, but this piece of property for the kids, they like it here. Especially my daughter wants to go. Rick has gotten his license and wants to continue with it. I think they're going to have to adjust and change, just like, you know, I had to and Greg had to, from fishing salmon of cohos and kings to pinks to fishing halibut and so forth. They're going to have to adjust into getting people to come in different ways. But it's so busy here now, you know, with boats and airplanes, and it's going to get more. I mean, we have two, if not three, of those mid-sized cruise boats coming in a day into the Idaho Inlet. Yeah. And, of course, how's that going to affect the estuaries? And our bears are changing their habitat, or their whole life is changing rapidly. They're being pushed back, especially the bigger, stronger boars are not acting the same at all. It's activity, a lot of activity.
What about their behavior has changed?
Well, it's interesting, like in Idaho Inlet here, the boats go up to the head and around, and even though they were trying to keep them from going into the estuaries, and I've tried to get Zach to be interested in this because these fleet, like National Geographic, they're building another boat now, but you got, 60, 70 people on a boat. You've got worries of invasive species getting into the estuary. You've got worries of that many people making a path down the estuaries, leaving trails that take a long time to heal. But even when you anchor in a place with your exhaust off the generators going, and people out in paddle boards and kayaking all over, especially during the mating season of June, late May and June. Those animals are no longer, the bigger animals are no longer coming out, and they're starting to push along the edges and finding them on points and things. And when I go to the outside coast that doesn't have that activity yet, they're still in the estuaries. They're still doing their same thing. What's that going to be in long-term effect? I don't know. But it's definitely affecting them. There's no question. No question at all. So tourism is going to be interesting. We had these meetings last winter, and this guy gets up and from National Geographic and says, well, the whole country owns this, and so they have the right to see it, and they need to be able to be here. And I just looked at him and says, well, everybody wants to go to the Super Bowl, but there's a fire marshal there that says only so many can go. So I don't know what's going to give, but boy, they're a strong force, very strong, very intelligent people, very good-looking people, very capable, gracious. But they want a bigger and bigger foothold.
You're talking about
National Geographic, UnCruz, all those mid-sized cruise boats. It's a big thing in this area. It's going to be a big thing. It's big now, but we've seen nothing yet.
And it's just only getting bigger and bigger.
Yep. And one of our things that's changing, too, with our bears is our fear of ticks, our fear of diseases that people carry from someplace else. Fleas have now shown up in a bigger scale where we never used to have, you know, the amount of fleas we have today. It's interesting. I'm sure that somewhat of a warm thing, but also just dogs. You know, it's kind of interesting because of, you know, the diseases and stuff that travel around the world you don't think about. You think tourism, that would be, but it's... people come into the Hobbit Hole from, may have been in a barnyard and down in some place. They bring something in on their feet. So, you know, we have people Clorox their feet, but asking those mid-sized cruise boats to Clorox their feet, or somebody at the Indian Islands. But those things come, and once they lock in, so that's one of the things that is going to be interesting to see what happens, huh? Hopefully people will, you know, be willing to give and try to work with it a little bit. But, you know, the potato blight in Ireland started from potatoes leaving. That was years ago, right? And those potatoes left South Carolina and went across to Ireland, and boom! So it's a concern of mine because something you can't see.
Right. What do you think is a way to prevent something like that from happening here?
Oh, I think just making an effort of limiting where, in certain precious areas where people are going to have to be really cut back on, find hard ground. You know, George Island is one of those. When you're taking hiking, try to take different trails. When you see animals, give them their room. You know, you don't have to habituate them, or you don't have to push them so hard that you chase them back. It's always, you know, I always look at hunting four kinds of things, but one I call coo hunting is taking pictures, and people just want to get closer and closer and closer. They want to fill that frame. It's not good enough to sit back and say. So, and of course, that's what these different outfits are pushing. You know, get up. And I'll watch, and nobody's exempt from wanting to do that. I mean, it's just part of human nature. You know, I was watching a set of kayakers just last year, and I was off the beach watching this bear with a group, and here comes a set of kayakers around the corner. As soon as they saw that bear, they turned right in and went right to him. But I'm going, come on, guys, leave that poor guy alone. But it's human nature. You know, they're not mean or bad people. It's just human. Can we educate people to not do that? Maybe some, maybe the commercial operators, but as a whole, pretty tough. I mean, you've got that problem all over California.
Mm-hmm. Right. I was wondering, like, is there a way to do tourism that's sustainable?
Well, obviously, it's something the Park Service fights all the time. Forest Service, they've got a set of different rules. We just went through what was the second shoreline management system, which I was hoping India and I don't get involved with, but shoreline two to put day use limits on. Yes, there's a certain amount of you're going to have limits. And to say just because you don't harvest a resource that you're not affecting it is just plain not true. Just plain not true. But people like to feel that that's the case, but it's just plain not true. So I don't know. I think the cow's out of the barn on a lot of this stuff. But I think eventually that's something that Indian Island Institute themselves are going to have to look at. What is the sustainable level of people coming there? Going to have to face it. There's going to be a want and a need to build a bigger and bigger deal and more people and so forth. This is exciting. And, just like the fox farm, how far are you going to go out to get a halibut? How far, where does it reach a sustainable level? But as long as there's somebody like Zach around, he'll figure it out and probably be more prudent than a lot of folks. Obviously, many of these folks like National Geographic, their growth spiral is incredible. I mean, Uncruise has gone from one boat, and what do they got? I don't know, 8, 9, 10, 11, I don't know. It's incredible. So, and what have we got at coming into Juneau this year of just tourists off tour ships? 1,300,000? And Hoonah's going to have, I should throw the numbers out for Hoonah because I don't know exactly, but they're building another dock. I mean, they're going to be way up there in numbers for a little town of Hoonah. It's big. So how do you figure that out? It's going to take some of your generation to do it. The torch is being passed, and you guys are going to have to do some figuring. What are the limits? I don't know.
On the flip side, so there's the impact that it makes, but what do you think is the value of someone who's maybe from, I don't know, California or Texas and seeing a place like Alaska for the first time and seeing the wildlife here?
You mean the effect on the individuals coming or the
Yeah,
economic effect of them coming?
for like an individual person.
Oh, I think it's huge. I think that obviously on our trips up here now, you're not talking the average person, right? You're talking people with money. Way a lot more money than you and I'll ever see for vast majority of them. For those individual kayakers, that was starting to come up pretty good. And, Southeast has not picked up like the Brooks Range has and those places where the Germans and Austrians and those folks are, they want to come and hike. Kayaking became pretty big for a while, and we don't see our individual kayakers that we used to. But for those folks, they gain a lot. They gain an awful lot. And I think that the imprint that those folks seeing this country is all healthy, and having wild places is all healthy for folks and important. But when do you love something to death? Can you do it in a manner where the stuff you leave behind, because everybody has an effect one way or another. Obviously, in this area, Gustavus, even in the commercial fishing fleet, one of the things we were hoping for at statehood was a creation of community where people lived here and were part of here. And that's going away.
Do you mean
Where,
here as in Gold Cove?
no, no. Yeah, Gull Cove, it was that way. And Gull Cove, of course, had people living here at one point in time. But no, Elfin Cove, Hobbit Hole pelican. With the permits, number one, are being sold, and they're being sold to people out of state. IFQs is huge now, the amount of halibut quota owned out of state. The lodges in Elfin Cove, whether they want to deny or not, the reality is they're not part of community in Alaska. They're here to wipe off and dust off the windowsill and make some jingle and go home. This isn't really home. It's not in here. That's the difference. And the people is true with National Geographic and Ann Cruz and all those folks. They're here and they're having a good time and showing people stuff, but it's not in here. The difference.
What do you think it takes to make it feel like
it? It's part of you. You can't separate the place out from your own inner feelings. It's a part of you. You live someplace long enough or go see your garden, it becomes a part of you. You couldn't live without it. It's just like water. You got to have it.
Is that how you feel about this place?
Well, yeah, I can't. I mean, I've played too much in this place, you know. I've got my special little spots around here. I've got a cabin that's halfway between here and Sitka that I spend the month of November at, So yeah, I don't go to Elfin Cove much anymore. But yeah, I live in the same bedroom, listen to the same whale I did when I was a kid. Exact same lady. She's got a broken blowhole, and yep. So.
How many people can say that?
I don't know, but how many people want to live in their house they grew up in? You know, I live in the exact same bedroom.
Is that here? Or
no, it's in Juneau. I live in Juneau in the winter. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So it's on the water, though, so I feel very fortunate.
Do you think what do you think you need to make it out here? Like, what sort of, do you think this place demands some sort of special qualities for you to feel part of this place and feel like you can survive here?
You mean mentally or physically or
just overall?
Overall.
What's do you think? Because you were talking earlier about how not everyone can make this place or can feel like this place is their home.
Oh, on that aspect.
Yeah, I was wondering.
Oh, I think people travel so much today, and have their home. Just amazing to me that people enjoy a lot of different places. They're not bedded to or wedded to a place. Where most of the older folks and some of my generation, you know, are wedded to the place. I mean, there's people may say, oh, well, that's really my home, but they don't want to put up with the winters and live in California or whatever. And they say, well, I've earned it, you know, or whatever the case. It's what you have in here, and everybody views that level differently. But, you know, we're in a very mobile society, and the internet and everything is, you know, people are looking on Facebook all the time, and I have internet here. I'm sure the Hobbit Hole's got internet now. And I find it fascinating that I'll get a group of people here now that I have internet. We used to have great discussions. Anymore, they're texting each other, you know, down below. They're looking what the news is or what's happened to the stock market or God knows what. What's happening to the women's soccer team, you know. The kids jumped up this morning. They're all excited because the women's soccer team won for the second year in a row. Is it? The second time in a row, right? I think so. Anyway, it's just people are more mobile and enjoy lots of different places. But, you know, guys like Greg, he's totally happy being, that's part of him. He's this, whether it's in the Hobbit Hole or in Gustavus, the country's just a part of it. He's totally satisfied just hanging around here because it's inside here. With Greg, it's even though he wasn't born here, it doesn't make a bit of difference. it's become a part of him. And that's not true with many anymore.
Do you see that in your children?
Yeah, a little bit. I've got wanderlust with one child, and one of them, this is a real part of it, really wants to work at it and keep it. Yeah. Although my other boy, my older boy, he's out commercial fishing right now, and you know, his deer hunting is a big thing. His going out and getting his fish is a big thing, and he works in a mine. So he's got a different perspective because he's working underground 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off for 12 hours a day. And when he gets outside, he's rolling. But he doesn't fly to Mexico or fly to Hawaii or go skiing or in someplace else. His life is here. So that's just who he is, too.
That's really special to have a place that you know inside you is home. I can't say if I feel that for myself, but
you might be going along your boat someday and throw out some roots and watch it grow. Could happen to you. You never know.
Well, I mean, is there anything else that you want to talk about? I feel like we've covered a lot.
Well, I think that the Howl boys should be very thankful to their parents, Bob and Doris, for getting him to Alaska, number one, but then Bob and the encouragement of him, of them getting the Hobbit Hole. I take my hats off to Zach to take it and go and run with it. I hope that they work more. I know they look at a lot of global issues, but my hope is they'll take some local issues on some more. It's happening fast, furious, and it's, of course, tough and political. I hope they maintain a certain fire marshal there that the Hobbit Hole doesn't get out of proportion to what's available. They have too many people love the place to let it go the wrong direction. But that's about it. I got great, great hopes for those folks, and I hope. I do have one other thing to add. I hope that Zach, over time, brings in people from different perspectives to look and talk and let people think outside the box instead of canned. I don't want to call it canned, that's unfair, but there are a lot of different reasons why things can work different ways. And I'm going to bring up a tough one for a lot of folks, and that is I take out bear hunts and we kill bears. And I've spent my lifetime working on bringing bear populations back. And it's one of the things in life I'm very, very proud of it. That people can understand how could you possibly kill an animal and then, but that's part of the population sustainability. And worked hard to keep habitat for them, worked hard to maintain harvest levels and, but when I first started doing that kind of work, if you saw five or six bears on a trip, you'd go, wow. But now we see 40 to 50, sometimes 60. Pretty cool. Pretty cool. But if I sat down with most people and said, you know, I take people out to kill bears, they go, what the hell are you doing? But it's a good economic, solid base. But times are changing there, too, where seeing any animal die is difficult. So, anyway, it's those things that's going to be working through your generation to see where things head, and you get to be a part of it. Be fun for you. And maybe you'll find a place to throw out your roots.
Yeah, we'll see.
It'll happen.
Thank you so much, Paul. Yeah. This was a wonderful interview.
I don't know if I was any help to you.